Good morning. So, as Marcia alluded to, every year the lectionary materials that we subscribe to suggest that a month be given to creation care. So they provide 4 Sundays worth of scripture-related materials, a sort of mini alternate lectionary every year. And this Sunday's suggested theme is storm. And while I can't say that I've spent a lot of time over the years thinking about storms or weather, really, in theological terms, I could immediately think of scriptures where characters engage with storms, two of which we read this morning. And I realized that storms do feel like a very apt metaphor given the actual weather disruptions we're experiencing more and more often now and reading forecasts about that. I heard many tornado stories, actually, as a child growing up, because my dad grew up in rural Nebraska. How seriously they took the sirens, the running to the shelters and the basements. But in my imagination, it all just sounded exciting, because no one in my dad's family ever died, no one ever got, carried away with the storm. And I confess that I never really took East Coast tornadoes, for example, very seriously. I figured the real ones were in the Midwest. Those were the real deal. But I learned the hard way that a tornado is a tornado is a tornado when we were living in Atlanta. In the summer of 2007 or 8, something like that, there had been tornado warnings perhaps more than usual that year, given that Atlanta is not really like a hotbed of tornadoes usually. But I had never been anywhere near an actual storm. It didn't really seem like it was coming to much, and so I wasn't paying very close attention. So on one summer day, Taman and I got in the car on a Saturday afternoon for a spontaneous trip to the movies. The sky looked a little murky, but I'm no, like, I didn't actually grow up in Nebraska. I just heard about it, you know. Which I think we commented on as we entered the highway, but nothing alarming. But all of a sudden, ahead of us, things were moving sideways that should have been moving down. Actually, nothing should have been coming down because this wasn't rain, it was stuff. And it looked a little like gravity had shifted or there was this great magnet off to the right, so things were going this way. All unanchored objects moving that way. Well, when you're going 65 miles per hour on the highway, you can cover ground pretty quickly. And so in the blink of an eye, we were in those winds. And I was driving, and I remember kind of squealing and hunching over the steering wheel as objects were flying by us. And then, crack, something hit the driver's side window, and it shattered. And thankfully, whatever object it was, I don't even know, because it didn't come in the car. I just know that suddenly there was no window. So I was squealing and trying to lean away from the window, but I was also trying to drive. And Taman was talking to me, probably very rationally and calmly, as he does. But I've never felt so vulnerable as I did that day driving down the highway with no window between me and the flying debris. Luckily, there was an exit right there, so we pulled off the highway and down to a light, and in my memory, the wind died down as quickly as it came up. I don't remember it being windy once we pulled over. And so with hearts pounding, we pulled over and under an underpass in downtown Atlanta. So I never saw a funnel cloud that day, but we did hear on the news that there was a tornado that came through Atlanta that day. And from then on, when we heard a tornado warning, we made for the downstairs bathroom. The only room in the house with no windows, there aren't basements in Atlanta. Atlanta's built on basically a granite slab. Stone Mountain is like a continuation of hard rock under the ground there. So me, Taman, our landlady, my 2 cats in crates, and her 3 large dogs crowded into that little room several times that summer. That in itself was a bit of a natural disaster, but nothing ever happened to us with the storms, and so I was very happy to be there each time. Dog breath and cat hissing and chaos at all. It was very beautiful. So I now respect the potential for destruction that a storm can bring. And I have so much greater respect for storm warnings, too, because of that. And when I read in the news about the likelihood that due to climate change and global warming, there will be more severe storms and that their severity will increase, it does not sound like a joke to me. In the words of the United States Geological Survey, with increasing global surface temperatures, the possibility of more droughts and increased intensity of storms will likely occur. As more water vapor is evaporated into the atmosphere, it becomes fuel for more powerful storms to develop. More heat in the atmosphere and warmer ocean surface temperatures can lead to increased wind speeds in tropical storms. And by the accounting of the National Severe Storm Laboratory, it was a whole different set of things I got to research this past week or so. It was very fun. Sobering things, but it was really cool looking at all these websites for severe storm work in the country. But they say that worldwide, there are an estimated 16 million thunderstorms each year. And at any given moment, there are roughly 2,000 thunderstorms in progress in the world. There are about 100,000 thunderstorms each year in the U.S. alone, and about 10% of those reach severe levels. So if I can still do math, which is a question, that's 10,000 severe storms a year just in the United States. In the insurance industry, such storms are legally referred to as acts of God. Any unpreventable and destructive event that is caused by nature. And the Judeo-Christian tradition has often agreed with that, seeing the intentional hand of God in acts of nature. You hear vestiges of it now. When a natural disaster hits the United States, some preachers will surely say that it is God punishing us for something, insert whatever is their pet peeve in the blank. And in the passage we read from Job today, God was literally speaking in and through a storm, a whirlwind, perhaps a tornado. He was speaking in this form to Job. You can see one artist's depiction of this on your bulletin covers. It's the image in the top right hand. "Who are you to question me?" the story says that God demands of Job. "Everything powerful on this earth you can think of, well, I made it, or I thought of it, and I control and command it now. So there, squishy mortal." If you envision the book of Job, which is a fascinating way to do to look back through it, as a rap battle, which Taman gave me the idea of, it's awesome, between Job and all his friends and God. But if you do that, then this is God's mic drop moment in the debate with Job. And with all this language of domination over nature, the writer was showing that this language was bringing out the big guns. God spoke in stormish, you could say, in other places in the Bible too. At least that's how those ancient writers present God to be at work. In the story of Jonah, God caused a storm to come forth over the water. In the story of Noah, God caused a storm to rain over the earth. Abraham bickers with God over God's supposed intention to rain fire and brimstone down upon whole cities. So yes, God speaks in stormish in the Bible. When we come to the New Testament, we find today's gospel story actually shows up in all three of the synoptic gospels, Matthew, Mark, and Luke. And in this story, we find that Jesus speaks stormish too. I guess it was a language spoken in the home growing up, perhaps. But as you can see in the dueling images on our bulletin cover, in the book of Job, God speaks through or in the storm, and in the Gospels, Jesus speaks to the storm, telling it to cease and desist. And that is like maybe the most hilarious image of Jesus I've ever seen. He's like doing some awesome karate ninja stuff there. But, yeah. So it's an interesting story. Jesus takes his disciples, many of whom were fishermen who had likely spent most of the waking hours of their whole life out on that very lake, which is actually the Sea of Galilee, so lake, sea. So it must have been a doozy of a storm if this particular boatload of people is fearing for their lives. Because there's a lot of fishing and a lot of Sea of Galilee in the New Testament, we've actually talked some about the Sea of Galilee this year. because I remember researching this. So apparently it's a pretty shallow body of water, and because it's the way that it's surrounded by hills, it's apparently known for the storms that quickly come up over the Sea of Galilee, frequently, but also with very little warning. So the sailors would not necessarily have been surprised by a storm. So again, this must have been a doozy for them to be responding this way. But it still seems odd that Jesus would chide these men for lack of faith, because it seems to me that only a great fool would not be afraid if their boat was filling with water in the middle of a storm in the middle of a lake. Which leads one to wonder, as one always should, I think, when reading a story, especially one in the scriptures, why was this story told? Why was it included? What was the intended moral of the story from the point of view of the writer? And of course, we can only speculate and interpret. But the story ends with the disciples seemingly coming to an awareness of the divinity of Jesus, and seems to want to remind readers of the Old Testament view of divinity as storm king. If he can command the winds and the water, who is he? Answer, obviously, he must be God. One commentator even speculated that Mark, whose version was likely cribbed and then embellished by Matthew and Luke, it's Luke's version in our bulletin, that perhaps Luke stole part of a story from Homer's Odyssey with this story, actually, and ascribed it to Jesus to help underline Jesus' divine identity, and to give it a familiar sound, perhaps, to Gentile readers who might hear echoes of a story about Greek gods, again, trying to, like, hint about divinity in this story. So it had been decades, I think, since I read any part of the Odyssey in college, so I'll remind you of the story since I needed reminding of it. Odysseus, you may remember, was on a journey. He was struggling to get home to his wife, and he became lost at sea before he and his crew landed on the island of Aeolia. This is just a tiny part of the Odyssey, by the way. After a month on the island, enjoying the hospitality of the god Aeolus, the god kindly offered to assist Odysseus and his men to their destination of home by confining all the adverse winds into a bag, because he was the god of storm and wind. And he sent them out only on a favorable west wind to push them safely home. So they're out on the water, they've got all the storm winds in a bag, and just a nice west wind to get them home. And it worked. They had lovely weather on the trip home. But the crew became curious about the contents of that bag. Was it really full of winds? How could it be? More likely it's a treasure of gold and Odysseus is hoarding it. You can see where this is going. So one night, literally, they just come into view of home. The whole point of the Odyssey is to get back home. It's been years. They're in sight of it. And while Odysseus is sleeping, the crew opens the bag and releases all the uncontrollable winds. The winds form a powerful storm which carries the ship right back to the Aeolia island. And Aeolus was not impressed with their faith in him. When I went back and read the story, I thought, this is not exactly a clear parallel here, but you do have a boat full of men with a sea that has been made calm by God, and the lack of faith of the men almost dooms them. Acknowledgement that a being who can control the winds and waves must be a god or must be divine figures in both of these stories prominently. What interests me is the human nature of this story. How quickly the crew of the boat forgets what it was like to sail in fear of a storm. This is the Odyssey crew I'm talking about. Once the god removed the possibility of storm, it did not make them more trusting. It actually made them less trusting. And they soon forgot that divine intervention had anything to do with their good fortune. So they released the bag of winds. If Mark was drawing on this story, he did make some welcome changes to it before it wound up in our scripture. But I wonder about the human factor in the Mark story and the human factor now as well. How quickly did the disciples forget that Jesus had calmed the storm for them? One of our country's most famous storms, if you can call them that, are the dust storms of the Dust Bowl years. In the 1930s, and mostly in parts of Texas, Oklahoma, Colorado, Kansas, and New Mexico. Some of the stories go broader than that. I've even heard up to 19 states. One account read, "Winds whipped across the plains, raising billowing clouds of dust. The sky could darken for days, and even well-sealed homes could have a thick layer of dust on the furniture. In some places, the dust drifted like snow, covering farm buildings and houses. Thousands of families simply abandoned their homes to flee the area, simply to survive." What caused this? Due to low crop prices and high machinery costs in the years leading up to the Dust Bowl years, more sub-marginal lands were put into production. And farmers also started to abandon soil conservation practices. And also, many of the farmers that moved to this area were used to the wetter climate here on the East Coast and were not really prepared for farming on the prairie. These events laid the groundwork for the, and I love this, Aeolian processes. Here's a reference to the Greek god of wind here, that led to the severe soil erosion that would cause the Dust Bowl. Then comes 1931, and so begins the first of four major drought episodes that come on the heels of these agricultural practices. And there were four major drought episodes that would occur over that decade. So it's frustrating to hear how much human ignorance and human short-sightedness contributed to this natural disaster. But this is what really grabbed me. Another drawback was that the return of the rains, that with the return of the rains after that, many people soon forgot about the conservation programs and measures implemented during the droughts in the 30s. And this led to a return of some of the inappropriate farming and grazing practices that made many regions so vulnerable to drought in the 1930s. And it makes me wonder about the wisdom of God calming the storm for us. If I was one of the disciples in that boat, I'm sure I'd be grateful for that ninja karate chop of Jesus's rebuking the storm and bringing calm. But I think of the storms around us right now, the tornadoes that we hear of with more frequency and severity, same with hurricanes. I think of the Amazon burning for some of the reasons it seems to me as the heartland of the U.S. did in the Dust Bowl years. And I wonder, will we ever change our ways if God keeps putting out the little storms, the individual storms that we heap our thoughts and prayers on one at a time? If they contain the fires in Brazil, will we keep eating the meat that demands that the rainforests be turned into ranches? Because that's why a lot of them are getting burned down. If the weather is unseasonably cool for a day, like yesterday, which was lovely, Will we be lulled into thinking, maybe climate change not an emergency yet? Maybe our prayers shouldn't be for the storms to cease, but prayers that we learn from the storm and not forget that the storms keep us awake and keep us bailing water out of our boats. As a recent report from the UN Human Rights Council reported, if our global climate change catastrophe continues unchecked, vast swaths of the world will likely become harsher and far less hospitable for humanity. This is their report in June of this year. When that happens, an even greater rift will appear between the global haves and have-nots, as many people will be left without the means to escape the worst effects of the climate crisis. An impending climate apartheid is what they're calling it. While the rich hire private firefighters or move to more expensive habitable areas, the report predicts that 120 million people will be pushed into poverty by 2030 by climate change, and many more will die. The report describes how the poorest 3.5 billion people in the world are responsible for 10% of the world's greenhouse gas emissions, while the richest 10% of the global population is responsible for half. But perversely, the richest who have the greatest capacity to adapt and are responsible for and have benefited from the vast majority of the greenhouse gas emissions, they will be the best place to cope with climate change. While the poorest who have contributed the least to emissions and have the least capacity to react will be the most harmed. In the report, They write how the wealthy's access to life-saving resources has actually caused humanity to adapt to the climate crisis in the wrong direction. Instead of acting to prevent or reverse the worst of climate change, the rich can afford to personally avoid the problem. An over-reliance on the private sector could lead to a climate apartheid scenario in which the wealthy pay to escape overheating, hunger, and conflict, while the rest of the world is left to suffer. In other words, miracles are great. You individually being saved from a storm is great. I'm very grateful that I was saved from a storm. But we must be thinking not just of our own escape from peril, but of all boats out at sea. And finally, after that depressing interlude about climate apartheid, here's a joke. Why did Jesus and the disciples cross the lake? To get to the other side. I don't know who said it. Yes! That might sound simple and stupid, but it was actually a helpful reminder for me. It can sound like the story and the storm were somehow just a setup for Jesus to perform his divinity, as if God's power is an end and of itself. But whether or not it was actually Mark's intent, that's not who I understand God to be. And it's certainly not the God I see Jesus' life pointing to. What was on the other side of the lake was the Gerasenes, a foreign and Gentile land. And it was here that they would literally embark. After this story of the storm, they would disembark from the boat, and Jesus would find a demon-possessed person, the demon named Legion, and Jesus would exorcise that demon and to possess a herd of pigs who would go running off the cliffs into that same sea to their deaths. Some say this was a very thinly, probably too thinly veiled political act of Jesus to throw out Legion when that's what the Roman occupiers called their troops. There is a whole nother sermon there, folks, and it's almost 10:30, so I'm not going there. But it's a reminder that Jesus didn't pull them out into that boat as a setup for divine self-congratulation, nor was the calming of the storm a way of shutting them up or deceiving them into thinking storms aren't really something to worry about. Jesus calmed that storm so they could get to the other side. The way their fear is interpreted in Mark is so emphasized that one way you could interpret those words is they feared a great fear, or even they were terrified of being so terrified. It sounds familiar. And their fear was after the calming of the storm. We can fear the storm and fear the miracle. But we still need to get to the other side, to not make life about the calming of our fears, but about getting beyond ourselves, the point being reaching one another across the stormy seas, leaving the familiar to sail to the other, where healing and transformation may await. So may we be grateful for the ways that Jesus calms our storms, but may we use that calm and security not to forget, but to assure ourselves never to give up, to keep striving for the other side, rather than to stopping at being grateful that our storm is over. Amen.